Hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the exuberant voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Indeed.
There is a reason you are exuberant, my friend, isn't there?
There is. We've had another great week here at Goalkeepers Union. Lots of listeners. Thank you, as always, for that. And thank you for spreading the word. But interestingly, a lot of professional goalkeepers getting in touch. Obviously, we know that Andy Lonergan and Frank Fielding are big fans of the show, but I've had several more this week, which has been really pleasing. Rich O'Donnell, in particular, at Bradford, who's a big fan, I believe. And there's been a few others. I won't name today, but really pleased that the word is spreading and it is appreciated.
Well, that's wonderful to know, mate. And in the past few podcasts, it's been noted, actually, I've received a few texts from people saying, who are these big guests coming up? Because Rich keeps promising big guests. Now, we normally do a bit of an intro, but we're not today because we've got a big guest and we are going to go straight into him, okay?
Fantastic. Let's do it.
Lovely. Well, first, I will just say, remember, if you want to contact us, it's very easy to do so. On Twitter, at GK Union. On Facebook, just search GK Union. On Instagram, it's at GK Union Official. Or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. Well, this week's guest is a man who, in achieving promotion with Burnley in 2014, became part of an elite band of goalkeepers to have played in all four tiers of English professional football. He began under Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United and moved to Cardiff and Bristol City before his big switch to Turf Moor, where he now resides as club captain. England international Tom Heaton, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you on. Now, we'd like to start with a little link between our guests and the man opposite me here today in Richard Lee. Now, Richard Lee's first game as a professional footballer, he was also treated to the first time he played in a game when a man was sent off. That man was a centre-back in front of him, his teammate Sean Dyche.
So if we're
exactly. Brilliant. If we're sticking on firsts, you were the first permanent signing of a certain manager at Burnley, and that man is obviously Sean Dyche. So a nice little link the
two
of you have.
Well played.
Superb.
There you go.
Absolutely superb.
Have you been getting on with Dyche?
Yeah, brilliant. You know, in fairness, bit of a strange one. He actually tried to sign me at Watford 12 months before I signed at Burnley. Went down there. I was leaving Cardiff City on a free. I was desperate to play. David Marshall had come into the team and played more than I had that year. So I decided to leave. Looked like Watford was going to be my destination. Went down, met the manager and all his staff. All went well. Thought I'd signed on the dotted line. Unfortunately, the club got taken over. He got the bullet. Struggled to get a hold of anyone at the club. And the contract got ripped up and under some legality they managed to get away with it. So it was strange when I first met him, really. You know, it didn't go to plan, but he stuck to his word. He said he'd always come and try and get me again. 12 months later I signed at Burnley, so since then it's been a really good journey.
He is a man of his word. I'd be interested to know your thoughts on him, because I say my experience of him was in a very different capacity as teammates for several years, and he was always a really interesting character. I mean, I've got so many stories, majority of which we can't really discuss on this podcast.
I have heard numerous rumours, shall we say, about his exploits as a player, yeah.
Do you know what? There's one, and I don't know whether I should tell it or not.
Go on.
I'll touch on it. There's one story. We used to always do the court on a Friday, you know, so any fines would then be brought up. And I try and do this in the nicest possible way. But basically, Sean Dyche was up on trial. I was the prosecutor. So we had this whole, like, kangaroo court thing going on. Eventually, they came to a verdict. And thankfully, they decided that I'd won and that Dyche owed £50. Anyway, Dyche knew he was going to lose the whole time. So let's just say that he had this £50 on him and he had it somewhere. And as soon as he knew he'd lost, he then presented me with the £50. I think you can kind of gather where that £50 may well have been. He was just
it
wasn't the most pleasant of individuals at times. To some extent, I can't believe he's gone on to do what he's done, because he was always a very powerful figure. He always spoke very well, and you know, he's very much a leader in the changing room. But I don't know, the fact that his career maybe wasn't at the highest possible level, and he was reasonably limited as a player, but what he's gone on since to do, and I know he's done a lot of courses in management, and obviously he's gone from strength to strength, to see what he's doing with you guys at the moment is phenomenal.
Yeah, that's right. I think that'd be more than fair. Obviously, since I signed at the club, I'm into my sixth season with Burnley. I think the word overachievement would probably be fair, to be honest, with the budget constraints, what we've done in that time. And that all comes down to him, to be honest. I think that's a good marker for him and where he sets his standards. You know, in terms of his personality, that comes through in his management, I think probably to a much lesser degree as a player. You know, we have good crack, but as long as you get the work done, you know, there's no messing as such. But in terms of having a good laugh, all being together, I think that's helped be our unique selling point, that real team unity, that real team togetherness, which we've had in abundance over that time, really.
So in terms of current Premier League managers, only Eddie Howe has been in a job longer than Sean Dyche. How far do you think he can go? Because to a fan, and Adjerno sometimes, it feels like he can be old school. Is he old school, or has he adopted modern methods and made it a sort of successful hybrid of the two?
I think to call him old school would be unfair. There's a lot of sports science goes into it. There's a lot of thought. He's not old school in his thinking in terms of training methods and the way we go about it. I think we can sometimes be pigeonholed as a team as a bit of a long ball, physical side that sort of get amongst it, which, don't get me wrong, we can play like that. The chess pieces we've got on our table allow us to do that. I think we often get misrepresented on the other side of the game as well. We actually play some decent football when we get going at the right time. It's just the fact that we're able to mix it, whereas other teams don't tend to mix it. We can use the two sides of the coin, really. And that, I think, has probably labelled us a little bit because we have that pragmatic approach. So, you know, old school certainly wouldn't be fair. And I don't think with an old school mentality in this day and age, you'd probably do what we've done as a team over the last sort of 6 years. As I say, I think that the marker of that is the success we've had.
No, absolutely. And naturally, you've worked with some big names over the years, none more so than Sir Alex Ferguson, who we mentioned at the top of the show. How does Sean Dyche compare to someone like Sir Alex?
They're different, of course. You know, I think each manager that I've ever worked for has their own way of going about it. The gaffer now has spoken and I think still speaks to Sir Alex and gets his opinion on things. I think he's certainly offered a bit of advice to him over the years, apparently, and I think he's mentioned that to me before. So I know that he likes how he went about it and how he did it. In terms of similarity, they're both of sort of autocratic styles, if you like. They're the men at the helm, they're in charge. I know the gaffer had Brian Clough at Notts Forest, and I think he certainly likes to add in his style that he had him at Forest, and I think his ideas. So yeah, I can certainly see some similarities there and other little bits and pieces from different managers, and it's really good to play for. You know, you sort of get a clear vision of what he wants. There's honesty on the table. There's no fluff around the edges. You get told what the situation is with no dressing on the side, really. It's just how it is. But I think as a player, when you get that, you appreciate it, to be honest, and you can work with it.
We're going to journey throughout your career on this podcast, but just before we get there, a quick word on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, because when you were at United, he would have been in the squad and coming to the end of his career, but you left in 2010, right? So does that mean that you were coached by Ole when he was reserve coach as well?
It does, strangely enough. I moved into the first team dressing room when Ole was still, I think he was still in there. And then I remember he had a season coming back from injury where he played a lot of football in the reserves, which was when I was playing in goal for them. I then had a few loan moves, went back to the reserves sort of towards the end of my time when he was manager. I can't remember if it was more than the pre-season, but I certainly spent a fair bit of time with him as sort of running the reserves. So yeah, it's been interesting to see how well he's done at the helm of United, really.
What kind of coach was he? Or is he, I suppose?
When I worked with him, he was very intelligent, understood the game very well, and tactically had a very good awareness of what he wanted. But I think what people might not know about him is the ruthless streak he's got. You know, I don't think you get the Man United manager's job without that streak, but it was certainly evident to me, making the tough decisions at the right time when it was required. You know, you could see that in him. I used to see that a lot in most first team players. You know, no matter how the personality came across in the sort of public eye, there weren't many in that first team dressing room that didn't have that ruthless streak, and he was certainly one of them. So you could certainly see the potential in the management that he had at the time and then what he'd gone on to do. And now, obviously, sat as the manager of Manchester United is brilliant, and I'm delighted for him. Delighted it's gone well for him, and I wish him all the best with it.
We'll stick with United because, of course, that's where you started your career. You were there from the age of 11. So I guess you would have seen some part of Peter Schmeichel among a whole bunch of other goalkeepers who came and went post-Schmeichel. One of those was Edwin van der Sar, who was number one when you kind of became a senior player. What was he like to work with on the training ground?
Edwin was fantastic. He was very, very strong-minded, knew what he wanted, and he was willing to get it. I think that sort of hit home to me, you know, what he required in training, and what he required of the defenders on a match day, what he required in terms of his preparation. He made sure he got it. You know, I thought he was absolutely fantastic for Manchester United. My hero growing up as a goalkeeper was Peter Schmeichel. There was a little bit of crossover when I was there earlier. I saw him a few times in training, and he was absolutely incredible, as we all know. But in terms of actually working with him, it was a bit early for me. And as he sort of transitioned out of the game, Edwin became that role model for me. And then to work closely with him was brilliant. You know, his thinking and his ideas were at such a high level. And it made me think more about my game, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to add in. Technically, he was excellent. But the biggest feature for me was the calmness that he played with. You know, he had an incredible presence, as Schmeichel did. But they were almost opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, there's different ways to skin a cat, but they both played with a massive amount of presence, and that composure from Edwin was something that I've tried to add into my game as the years have gone on.
You touched on a couple of bits there, and I wanted to dig into this a bit because I remember we were, obviously I was a couple of years older than you, so very aware of your progression elsewhere at the time. The big thing for me was intelligence as a goalkeeper, but also technically. You know, you're always very, very solid when it came to your technique. Going through the youth age groups at Manchester United, was there a particular coach, or was it the likes of Van der Sar, Schmeichel, where you had mentors above you that you were able to feed off? What was your approach? How did you get your technique to where it is now?
Technically, I knew I always wanted to be right on it. I mean, I was very fortunate to have worked with some great coaches at Man United. And I think there's probably a mix of both, really, having top people, top players to work from and around and with, and then top coaching to go with it. You know, there's numerous names that I worked with at Man United. Tony Cotton was obviously a first-team coach there. I had a little bit of time with Eric Steele. Rich Hart has had a massive impact on me, you know, all the way through, really, because he brought me up through the academy, and then he got the first-team job as well when I was in amongst it, which was great. Dave Rouse, who's now at Man City, had a big impact. Dave Ryan very early on. Even just from that list, yeah, just at United, you know, you're talking about six, seven, eight coaches that have all added something in. And I tried to be like a sponge and take the ideas from them, put them into practice, see if they worked. And I was very sort of analytical in how I went about it, saw what worked, discarded what didn't, and tried to go from there, really. And I think getting the basics to the highest possible level was always something that was drilled into me from a dad, really, at a very young age. So that's probably the route that the technique came from.
You just touched on your dad there. I was going to ask you about motivation, because it's always interesting speaking to different goalkeepers as to what, with want of a use of a better term, like their reason why. What was the reason that helped you get to the level you got to? You know, 11, 12, 13 years old, kids your age are off doing all sorts of different things, yet you're having to train however many times a week, play a game every single weekend. What was the biggest driver for you at those younger years?
It's a very good question, that, and I've often wondered myself a little bit about my background. I mean, I think I wasn't from a wealthy family, but didn't want for anything, if you like. Both parents were teachers. You know, I had a really nice childhood. I look at it, I'm not quite sure where that drive came in, but it was certainly there. For me, I wanted to be a Premier League goalkeeper. I wanted to be England's goalkeeper. And I was going to do anything to get there and consistently do as much as I possibly could. I remember growing up playing in four or five local teams, you know, the Cubs, the Sunday League teams, the local sides, and playing as much as I could. I played outfield, I played in goal. And I remember one of the older kids saying to me, yeah, you know, you love it now, but in 3 or 4 years' time, no one enjoys any football anymore when they get to 15, 16. I remember having sleepless nights when I was 12, thinking, am I not going to like football anymore? Thinking it was actually a real worry for me. I can't put my finger on it, to be honest, but I've certainly always felt it. I've always felt it in abundance. I feel it now at 33 more than ever. You know, the fire's still burning. I still want to get better. I still want to improve. There's still things that I want to achieve. So I'd probably look at my parents in terms of doing everything you can to get to where you can get to. That's probably the ultimately who it came down to that installed it in me.
So as we mentioned, Tom, you were at United from the age of 11. You spent 13 years with the club, roughly, I don't know, 20 matchday squads as a substitute, but never managed to make that first team appearance. You did, however, play in that UEFA celebration match in 2007, which was the celebration of United being in Europe for 50 years. Kind of one of those exhibition occasions. And I've got to say, sadly, I'm going to have to bring it up. Mr. El Hadj Diouf.
Yeah, brilliant.
Outrageous. How dare he have the audacity? It was a Panenka penalty, right?
It was.
Unbelievable.
It was an interesting moment, I have to say. I mean, it didn't overshadow my evening, to be honest. I thought, you know, it was my first sort of, I classed it as a first-team game. It was a friendly fixture, but it was still a first-team game in my eyes. I think Thomas Kuchak came off at half-time with an injury. You know, playing against a European select 11, so there was obviously some top players out there. You know, playing at, I'm pretty sure it was a full house at Old Trafford, and certainly 50,000 plus, I think, at the time. So it was a big night for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Another marker, another step forward, another sort of challenge to embrace. I think I conceded two in that second half, but I really enjoyed being out there. And it, as I say, it just sort of added to that hunger. You know, we talked about motivation before, just added that little bit of taste, that sort of level, that sort of players, that sort of stage. You know, you get a feel for it, and you want more of it. You want to chase it, and I think that was a rung on the ladder for that, certainly.
How did you feel before that game? Because I guess that would have been by far the biggest game that you'd played at that particular time. Are you the type of goalkeeper that just relishes playing games of football, or do you get some nerves before the game? I mean, even now, are you quite good at balancing the mental side of it in terms of how hyped up you get for a game?
If I'm honest, I think I am now. In fact, I would arguably say that's probably been one of my strongest points in the last sort of six, seven, 8 years in terms of the mental strength to sort of perform, get myself in the same state to perform week in, week out. And it only is because I've worked on it very strongly. And I, the best example I can give is I went on loan to Cardiff City, I think it was, when I was 22. You know, I had a couple of loan moves. First one, you know, it's like young goalkeepers, sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down. Had good days, bad days. Went off to Antwerp. Went back to Man U for a couple of years as number three, which was great. All building the foundations for the career. And I went to Cardiff, playing the Championship, big club, great opportunity. And I was okay. You know, I was okay. I had some good days, some not so good days. But there was a burning frustration inside that I just wasn't producing what I felt I was capable of. You know, I think I wasn't fulfilling my potential in what I felt I had. And I couldn't put my finger on it. Again, I spoke to a few of the coaches, a little bit of my support team with my dad and what have you. And we looked at it and I spent some time working with a few different people over the next sort of couple of years, NLP, psychologist, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I didn't have a problem. I just felt there was more there. And I think I've carried that on since that day, I'd say 11, 12 years ago. And now I think it's probably my biggest strength in the game. People often talk about in football, not necessarily in other sports, but in football as though it's almost like a weakness or you have to have a problem or you've got a major issue, but it's not that way at all. For me, it's about getting more out of yourself, your body, you know, whatever it is, through the mental side and maximising what you've got. And I think that's certainly how I've gone about it and how I've felt with it.
Just to back you up on that, I mean, I ended up going down the route of doing the NLP qualification, then Master Practitioner in Neurolinguistic Programming, just for the fact that I think for all the different muscles you can work, all the technical work that you can do, physical work, power, strength, flexibility, etc., your mind, arguably, is the biggest thing to train as a goalkeeper.
Totally agree.
I mean, even more so at the level that you're playing week in, week out. We're seeing it at the moment, David De Gea, some of the stick that he's getting from the press publicly. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are speaking about him. So the mental strength you need, if you're in that situation, to then get yourself through it and keep moving forward, arguably more so than any other position on the field.
Totally agree. It's a reactive position, so you can't play your way in. Something goes wrong, you haven't got someone else behind you to bail you out. You know, you can't go and feel your way into the game. Goalkeeping is purely a reactive position. You're reacting to what happens in front of you. So nothing's ever the same. There's a lot going on. And there could also be a lot of time in between, which can be difficult. So you have to be really on the ball, really in control of your mind. And that's why, for me, especially as a goalkeeper, it really is vitally important, that mental side of it.
We're going to come on to Burnley a bit later, Tom. But just while we're on this mindset and psychology stuff now, I just wanted to touch on an interview I saw you give after you were out injured for a period. And you were initially out at the start of this season. You came back. There was only 3 wins all season. And then you went 8 without defeat when you came back in. And you were credited largely with the upturn in fortunes. I think it was after the West Ham game. You said, you know, you'd learned a lot personally with yourself, different situations and what's important. What did you mean by that in terms of learning a lot personally?
What I meant by that was the fact that up until that point in recent times, up until the point where I got injured, which was, I think, September 2017, something like that. You know, everything been going well for the last few years. Got in the England team. I'd just started for England. Been on a comfortable journey. You know, it'd been good. It had been great. It'd been all going in the right direction. And not that you forget, but you just get used to things going well. You know, I think that's how it was. I got the injury. Didn't realise the severity of it at the time. Didn't realise the journey it was going to take to get back. That really, that moment, that West Ham game, getting back out there, was a sort of full stop to that part. I was ready to start a new chapter, if you like, from then on. And then what I meant by what I'd learned from that time was the fact that, A, how much I wanted it, you know, how much I was desperate to get back playing better than I ever have done. So I learned a little bit about that. When I felt I was back fit after the shoulder, the 6 months not playing was dealing with that frustration again when things aren't going in your way, even though I felt right, felt like a caged animal to some degree. You know, I feel I want to be out there playing. I've missed a lot of football and I'm not getting the opportunity. But at that point, what do you then do? How do you deal with that? What's important at that time? What's important is you're getting the work in, you're improving, something's getting better, you're not coming in, going through the motions day in, day out just because you've got a bit of a face on and you're feeling a bit frustrated. At that point, you've got to work even harder. And I think that's something that took me a few weeks to get my head around it, but I think I got there in the end. I put the work in, day out, because I was ready for the next opportunity. I wasn't sure where it was going to be, if I'm honest. I wasn't sure it was going to be at Burnley at the time. Couldn't see the sort of steps going into that, but I thought another opportunity was coming, it was going to be around the corner, and I wanted to be ready to take it. If I'm honest, that's what I meant, and I think missing the football, you get back out there, you're playing Premier League football, everything that I've always wanted to do. So I made sure that I was going to appreciate it, and I think with that, I came a bit of a newfound freedom, if I'm honest, being back out in there, making sure I'm enjoying every second of it, maximising it, but yeah, making sure I'm appreciating it at the same time.
Okay, well, speaking of newfound freedoms, we'll just rewind back to United, and at the age of 24 you decided to leave. and you left on a free. Now, Sir Alex Ferguson wanted you to stay. You were offered a deal, but you declined it. How did that go down with Sir Alex?
For me, it was all about playing. You know, I had a long time at United. I knew everyone all the way through. It was comfortable. But I think, for me, there's a couple of moments. You know, the Champions League final, I was third-choice goalkeeper. I think the 24-man squad travelled over there. I was in the dressing room before the game, watching how the best prepare. They beat Chelsea on penalties. It was a brilliant night, brilliant day. But there was certainly a deep-lying thought in there that thought, watching this, you know, I want to be on there. I want to have an impact on the game. That's what I want to chase. That's what I want to do. So I knew that I wanted to play. I didn't see the route to going. The level at Manchester United are at, they need to pick the best in the world at that moment in time, you know, whoever's playing. So that tends to come as an outsource. If you've got an untried and tested individual, it's difficult to see that route through. You've got to be doing it week in, week out for the level of Manchester United to go to that number one spot. And even if you'd offered me the number two spot, I say this now, but it wasn't what I wanted, you know, what I wanted to be with playing. I wanted to go and have my own journey, see if I can test myself, see if I can produce and fight my way back to the top. That was the goal when I left.
It's that classic catch-22 situation, isn't it, where, and you see it, I'm trying to think, the last goalkeeper that's come through a club and actually come through one of the top six and go on to play regularly. I mean, if we were to think about Manchester United, the last goalkeeper to actually come through and play for the club, it does feel like it's been such a long time, because naturally they're always going to look at the very, very best around the world. And if you're coming through, you might be as good as a David De Gea, for instance. However, if you haven't got the experience, then would a top-class manager, top end, when they're fighting for Champions League and millions of pounds worth on every single game, would they ever give the chance to a youngster who hasn't done it? It is a catch-22, right?
It is. It's difficult. Never say never. Of course you wouldn't, you know. I'll be the first to tell you that I wasn't good enough at the time either. You know, when I left at 24, I didn't have the skill set to go and play there as number one goalkeeper. I just didn't. I didn't have the experience, didn't have the know-how, didn't have the practical element to my game. You need to go and learn that. I certainly did. Others may be different. For me, I wasn't at that point. I needed to go and play games to understand, to improve, to learn what's required. I'm a lot better now than I was at 24, leaps and bounds. So, you look back, I wouldn't have been right for that. Not that the opportunity was there, but you know what I'm saying? It wouldn't have been right. Other people might be different. There's obviously the old adage, if you're good enough, then you're old enough. I totally agree. I just think it is a difficult scenario based on at that level. Young goalkeepers need to learn. They haven't got any evidence to sort of back it up. It's tough. You know, they can't really afford that because it's fine margins.
You were used primarily at Cardiff as a cup keeper. And you did make the League Cup final. I think it was a 2012. You played against Liverpool in a game that went to a bizarre penalty shootout where three of the first six were either missed or saved. And you saved that first penalty from Steven Gerrard, no less.
Yeah, it was a big moment. Probably the biggest, I think, if I'm honest, for me. It sort of left United looking to get back to playing at the highest level I possibly could. I'd gone to Cardiff. I'd played the majority of the games the year before, but had a couple of injuries. They brought Dave Marshall in. He was then picked that season under Malcolm Mackay as the number one. So I was restricted to the League Cup games, but thankfully went on a great run and got the way to the final against Liverpool at Wembley, of course. And as I look at it, for me, that was the biggest moment of my career. You know, it was at Wembley, 90,000, playing against the standard of team that I was aiming to compete against, you know, Liverpool, Premier League side. And having no evidence of performing really against that sort of team so far or at that level or on that stage. You asked me before, Rich, about the sort of nerves and the anxiety. I think that's human. I certainly felt them a lot that day. But I used the skills that I've been building up. I used that sort of routines, the ideas. I turned it into excitement. I thoroughly enjoyed the game. You know, I absolutely loved every minute of it. I was really, really pleased with my performance. And the icing on the cake really was saving Steven Gerrard's penalty. Obviously, unfortunately, we ended up coming out on the wrong side of it. But that moment for me stuck out because that was a real marker of the belief that I could do it. And I think that's played a big part in my career, that game and that moment going forward.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of bits I just want to touch on there. One thing that you said, that you turned it into excitement, and it's something I say to a lot of young goalkeepers, that nervousness and excitement are so similar. There's such a fine line between the two, and actually you can turn nervousness into excitement very easily just by changing certain thought processes and certain thoughts that you have. The other one is a classic one, believe to see or see to believe, and two different types of people, two different mindsets. But actually, I guess going into the world of football, you need to be of the mindset that you believe to see, you don't need to have done it in order to go and do it. So you're going into a game like that. It is the unknown. You keep using the word evidence, which I find fascinating, because it is. A lot of the time, you're going to go into a brand new situation where you haven't got evidence. You haven't been able to show that you can do it before. So you need to believe it before you actually go and do it, before you see it. And obviously for you, that's been a key part. But then once you do it and you have that success, then all that does is then build your confidence.
You're absolutely bang on. I think it's not so much the reinforcement that you can then do it. It's the reinforcement that you can believe in, the believing before you see it, if you know what I mean. If you throw caution to the wind and you believe in it, even if it's a new experience, if you like. If you've had experience believing in things and it's come off previously, then you can believe in it again, if you know what I mean. It's not the actual substance of, you know, sounds like I'm talking in riddles here, but I think I know what I'm getting at.
No, look, it's something that, again, we could have a private chat on psychology. No, because I go into it as the creation of reality. Ultimately, it is just the thoughts in your head. You can think about a game that's upcoming and get yourself incredibly nervous if you think about how windy it is, if it's wet, if the referee's going to make bad decisions, if your teammates might say horrible things. All these things that can make you very nervous. Or similarly, you can flip it very easily, and you use that word there, that you change it to excitement. Actually flip it. What about if you're going to be man of the match today? What if you can give absolutely everything you've got and you end up being the hero and you win 1-0 and you play in bigger and bigger and bigger games, and the feeling that that will bring? But again, it's a simple shift of mindset, and all of a sudden you've created very different emotions in yourself just by having that solid mindset.
Couldn't agree with you anymore. I think that is absolutely bang on. You know, for me, people look at the best players in the world and they look them on the TV and they think about themselves, and you think about nerves and anxiety before games, a little bit of agitation, but that is human. I mean, that is not a problem. That is not a problem to have that. People get it in varying degrees, I think, but it's a natural response. It's what you do with that response that's important. You know, the psychologist that I work with, a guy called Carl Morris, who I've worked with the last 4 or 5 years, you know, I have a great relationship with him. You know, we talk about it, and I often speak to him about it. We talk about it. In your mind, label it energy rather than nervousness, or, you know, if you label it energy, you can shift it into whatever you want. You know, you can actually use it. You're playing goal, it's not always going to go your way. If you start as a goalkeeper, you cannot expect to be perfect week in, week out. There are going to be goals going that you're probably going to cost your team. You're obviously trying to minimise it as much as possible, but you've got to accept that it's going to happen. So if you start at that baseline and say, look, it might happen. If it happens, I can deal with it. But what do I actually want to do today? You know, what do you actually want to go and do? You want to perform at the highest possible level. Go and enjoy taking that challenge on. Go and embrace it. And I think that's the shift in mentality that really, really helped me, especially early on in my career.
I feel like I should be paying for this, this little session. This is unbelievable. I still actually can't quite figure out whether I'm supposed to be believing what I see or whether I'm supposed to be seeing what I believe.
I think I confused myself in there. Yeah. I think I knew where I was starting with that.
Well, just quickly end on Cardiff. A common feature, as we've learned on this podcast, is a certain individual named Stephen Bywater. Now, he was with you for a short period at Cardiff. Other goalkeepers we've had on the podcast have had a story or two to tell about a man who we can't wait to try and get on this podcast, because it seems like he's quite an enigma, Mr. Bywater. Any stories to tell?
A couple. And obviously, what a brilliant character. I really, really liked him. Real interesting character, a top goalie. I mean, my memory's not the best, to be honest, but I have a vague recollection of being, he came on loan, I think I might have been injured at the time, but I was with the team and he was ill in the night, and he just sat up in reception and took himself off to hospital on his own, like, you know, didn't tell anyone or anything like that. And he was just a real interesting guy, but offered a lot to a dressing room just because he was so different.
Brilliant. Well, at the end of your time at Cardiff is where it all changed, because by 2012 you'd been in the game for around 10 years. You'd made a select number of appearances, mostly loan spells and those two in and out seasons at Cardiff, and then you joined Bristol City. And we're roughly 7 years from that, and you've made in excess of 150 appearances and have pretty much been a starter whenever fit. So what clicked and what went right? Or I guess, more to the point, what changed in your career?
I think I was improving. That, an opportunity again. I left to Bristol City, signed there with the hope of having a real successful year. You know, I was excited by the challenge. I mean, I actually went on trial for the week leaving Cardiff. I left Cardiff because I said I wanted to play. As I had said previously, that's what I was chasing. And I think that's when I signed at Watford. It got ripped up and it put me back a little bit that summer. So I actually went and did a week training camp with Bristol City, which was only 7 years ago, which it's interesting how things turn in the game. Did everything I could, managed to get a contract, started the season. I think I played 43 of the 46 league games that year. Unfortunately, we finished bottom, I think, got relegated out of the Championship. And that's where Burnley signed me up. But I think to go and play consistently was a big thing. It was the first time I played certainly at that level, a full season's football. You know, I learned a lot from it. I was pleased with my output generally. Even though we'd been relegated, I thought my performances were decent. And it was a building year again. You know, it was another step forward for me, and I was looking forward to the next one. Thankfully, that came with Burnley.
And it's funny because you mentioned the fact that it was a poor season generally for Bristol City. 84 goals conceded that season. I think it was the worst in the division. Yet the following year, obviously, you signed for Burnley. Only 37 goals conceded, which was the best in the division. You kept 19 clean sheets, yeah, which was the second highest. And you got promotion and finally fulfilled the dream of playing in the Premier League.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, clean sheet is a marker of what goalkeepers want. It's the base level of what you want. You don't want to concede goals. But I also have the thing of you can't save everything or a lot of stuff in that 84-goal season. But for me, it was about doing everything that I could to keep the ball out of the net. If it goes in, I've done all I could. I can live with that. So yes, we shipped a lot of goals that year. But it's not something that I judge my performances by, if I'm honest. I know that sounds strange, your idea is to keep the ball out of the net. But you can only do what you can do. There's a lot of variables in goal. And that's how I look at it. So it didn't really affect me. So the 2 years there with one of the worst in the Championship record and one of the best in the Championship record, it's not really a marker for my performance in myself, to be honest. It's when I analyse the game, how I think that I've gone about it, how I think I've done. Not really the stats behind it.
Yeah, and just on that note, because you've got a good example would be this season when you look at Edison and Neil Etheridge, for instance. The amount of shots that Neil Etheridge has had to deal with this season compared to Edison, we're talking three, maybe four times as many, yeah, which naturally will mean he'll make a lot more saves. But similarly, he will, law of averages, make more mistakes and, of course, concede more goals. Yet, I do still find that we are in an age of people talking about the number of clean sheets where really, you know, we've both been there. You can end up keeping a clean sheet and not playing particularly well or having absolutely nothing to do. Similarly, you could lose a game 4-0 and be man of the match.
Totally agree. It just doesn't tell you the whole picture. You know, I think we've, you know, the money ball thing, I think, sent it that way a little bit with a lot of the stats. And there's obviously things you can take from it, but it doesn't always tell you the whole story. For me, certainly, when I'm analysing myself on a personal note, I think I know myself, what I was doing at the time, what I was thinking, what I wanted to do, how I should have done it. And I go back through that and analyse these things. And I think that comes from within, really. It's not an outside source saying, well, you conceded no goals in five games, it means you've been great. No, it doesn't. You know, it doesn't by any stretch. And by the same token, on the other hand, it doesn't mean it the other way. And I think that helps with a solid foundation of not getting too up or down with how things are going, win, lose or draw. I think if you can look at yourself in that analytical way, I think it probably helps not be too fragile with your confidence and things like that.
Tom, we've got to talk about Mr. Ibrahimovic. You returned, yep, to Old Trafford a few years back. Played against United. It was 0-0. You had an absolute stormer of a game. 37 shots that evening. You made 11 saves, which was the same as David De Gea actually earlier this season against Spurs, and everyone talked about that. But you made one incredible save from Zlatan.
Yeah, I remember it. It was a sore one at the time, I have to say. I think Juan Mata wasn't too happy, thought I was feigning injury at that, but I can guarantee him that I was not feigning injury. It was really sore on the old elbow, that one. It was obviously a great night. We went to Old Trafford, you know, it's a tough place to go. It was one of those nights that we were digging in. We were in the trenches with the helmets on, you know, backs against the wall, but we dug it out. Some of the defensive work in there was excellent. I was obviously busy that night. I think we gave it away, but I think we won it back and gave it away on the edge of the box. I think Jesse Lingard came in down our left side, looked up and saw Ibrahimovic at the back, and he's lifted it. A few of our lads have made it back onto the line. I've made the decision to go out and throw a bit of a shape at him, try and close the space down. And, you know, in fairness, with his agility and his acrobatic sort of ability, he's bicycle kicked it, caught it clean. And thankfully, my arm was in the right place at the right time and managed to keep it out. So it was obviously, it was sort of cherry on the cake for a really good night, you know, getting a clean sheet at Old Trafford. And a point was brilliant, really. It was a brilliant point. We were obviously delighted with it, but the overall performance was probably more important to me.
That's quite funny that you said your arm is in the right place at the right time, thankfully, because we talked at the start of this show about how sometimes players can dumb their performances down after they finish playing football. But for you to say, thankfully, my arm was in the right place at the right time, I mean, that was calculated, right? That was a proper Schmeichel spider to stop that goal from going in.
Two ways of looking at it, really. I think the skill in that one is probably the speed to get there, perhaps the decision to go and do it. And the physicality to get there and get a wide spread, get up in the air and spread. For me, that's a blocking save. You know, the skill in that, in what happened there was those things. You know, it's not a reactive save as such where I'm making almost like a wall-like feature and he's hit it against it. You know, I've not reacted to that shot. There just wasn't enough time to. So I'm almost just trying to fill the space in the hope he puts it there. And thankfully he did. So it's a different kind of save. You know, it's obviously they've all got their place. And yeah, thankfully the outcome of that one the timing of it against that player at that stage, it turns out to be a top save, I think.
No, absolutely. And I just want to touch on the situation at Burnley at the moment, because it's quite unique. For me, I can't recall one like it in recent years. I mean, Southampton have kind of got a similar situation now with Angus Gunn and Alex McCarthy and Fraser Forster. But at Burnley, it's you, it's Nick Pope, it's Joe Hart, all arguably number one goalkeepers. Anders Lindegaard is in reserve too. So in this scenario where you have three goalkeepers, something has to give, right? And we spoke with Joe Hart at the start of the season, but it was at a time when everybody wasn't fit. Now they are. So how does this relationship and this situation pan out?
Yeah, quite easily, really. I think most people are surprised by this. Of course, it's a different dynamic. You know, we've got me, Popey, Harty, Anders Lindegaard. We've also got Adam Legston's there, five senior goalkeepers, I think all 27 and older. So, yeah, it's a different dynamic. It's a bit of a strange dynamic in terms of most football clubs. But it's quite straightforward from in terms of where my thinking is. You know, that's not in my control. Can't control who the club bring in. Can't, to a degree, choose who the club selects to play. All you can do is do what you can do. We have a fantastic relationship personally with all the lads. You know, there's no issues with that at all. We all get on. We all understand the challenges sometimes, especially in goal when there's only one position we all want to play. So I think there's a healthy respect there. We all support each other, whoever's playing, because we know it's not our decision. But at the same time, it always comes down to that intrinsic thinking in terms of yourself. You know, I want to get better. I want to be playing. And it's about what I'm doing, not about what anyone else is doing. And it's as simple as that, really.
So that's the bit that intrigues me, is not being a footballer, and Rich probably has something to comment on this as well, but you said there you're obviously all close, you get on, you respect each other, and it's not your decision, but you're also in a position where you're trying to usurp each other to reach that number one position. So is it ever awkward where, you know, you earlier this season you came back in for Joe Hart, but is it just the norm that you all get on with it?
That was the situation with us. I mean, of course, Harty knows I want to play. I know that Harty wants to play. I know that Popey wants to play. I know that all the lads want to play. And I wouldn't begrudge them that. You know, I would expect that as a professional. You know, I think that's right. I think the only thing you want, and we've certainly got that in abundance, and I certainly tried to do it at the start of this season. I've certainly felt it from the other lads, is the support in terms of, you know, the warm-ups, the support, as I say, that talking to each other about the games and training, getting the best out of each other. And then it's down to you and what you produce. I mean, I think I understand you say you're trying to usurp each other, which is true to a degree. I was brought up at United where, you know, when I signed at 11, they were looking across the world at bringing goalkeepers in a different age group. So you're not, you know, the lad stood next to you in the squad isn't necessarily just your competition. You're competing against every other goalkeeper in the world at the end of the day. You'd be giving yourself sleepless nights if you're worrying about anyone else. So for me, I've always channeled my thinking into me, what I'm doing, what I'm performing, and there's always something you can do better. There's always something you can improve. So I tried to use the focus at looking at that rather than anything else.
It's actually quite a nice quote I saw recently, which was, it's always you versus you. It always has been, it always will be. And I think it's quite easy to have that external focus. You mentioned, use the word intrinsic in terms of motivation, extrinsic, but just understanding that it is always internal. And the second you start looking outside of yourself, yes, if you're using it as a marker and somebody you want to get to and maybe overtake, and it is a positive motivation, then that's great. But I guess it's the moment that it becomes a concern and actually you take your eye off the ball because you are competing with somebody else, it can become a little bit of an issue.
I think so. I mean, we're all different. We all have different ways of doing it. It's just never been my way, that to look at it as like a me versus you sort of competition. You know, for me, you know, you can't get away from the fact that to a degree it is that. As the football club looked at it, there is a bit of who's going to play out the ones we've got available. But in terms of my thinking, it's never been on the plate, that.
So moving on to England, you made your England debut shortly after your 30th birthday. Was there ever any part of you that thought this wasn't going to happen now? Had you given up hope, or did you fully believe that that was still going to come?
No, never given up hope. Never lost any belief, if I'm honest. You know, I think I came to fruition, if you like. I was improving a bit later in my career. As I said, I left United at 24. Ideally, I'd have left earlier and gone and started that journey of trying to forge my career. Earlier than that, it didn't happen for numerous different reasons. So I was always a little bit behind the curve. But I also think I've always improved on that journey as well. You know, all the way through, I've left. I've got better each year. And I just think that's where my journey took me. You know, I don't limit it in terms of age. You know, I feel now, you recently turned 33, feel better than ever physically, technically, mentally. So I still feel like there's more to come. So no, if I'm truly honest, I've never had any doubts of where I was aiming or thought I'd missed the boat by any stretch.
Well, first Burnley player to be called up for England since 1974. The first goalkeeper since 1974. 58. You played in that Euro 2016 warm-up game against Australia. I read that you referred to it as 6 minutes and two touches.
Yeah, that's right. We were cruising, I think, 20 minutes to go, and I got told to warm up. And a nice story, actually. I think we conceded to make it 2-1. And Roy Hodgson was the manager at the time, and he was on the sideline. He was getting sucked into the game. I was out there warming up for a good 10, 15 minutes, and it was actually Joe Hart that reminded him to get me on the pitch. He was on the bench at the same time. I think Fraser Forster was playing. And Harty gave him a nudge to remind him that I was out there warming up, and I'd been for a good 15 minutes, so get me on. And in fairness, they did it, got stripped off and got out there. And yeah, it was a brilliant moment. Fraser came off, I jogged onto the pitch, got a nice reception from the crowd. Clapped them back as I've run on, and literally just a massive beaming smile came on my face that I was trying to hide, but I couldn't stop it. It was a great moment. I really enjoyed it. As you say, two touches, but they meant the world to me.
You went to Euro 2016, then it was Joe Hart, Fraser Forster and yourself. You didn't get game time, but you must have soaked up that atmosphere. And I was there actually for the Wales game. We won that one, but that kind of seemed to be the only bright spark in what was a pretty unfortunate tournament, I suppose you could say. So what was the feeling like after that Iceland game, and how did it not really work out with Roy Hodgson and Gary Neville, his assistant?
If I'm honest, I thought the preparation was excellent. It was just one of those things that it didn't go our way, as football sport can do. You know, I thought we were going a long way in the tournament, the ability we had, the way we were set up. You know, people look back at it now and have a clouded view on it, in my opinion. The Iceland game obviously didn't go to plan. It wasn't what we all wanted. You can never guarantee anything. Football, in sport, in life, very few things can be guaranteed. It didn't work. And at the end of the day, I think that's why, you know, the manager and the coaching staff, of course, sort of a couple for that and end up leaving. Probably wasn't a fair reflection on how I thought the tournament was going to go. I thought we were going to go a really long way. We had a very good side, a very good setup. But it just shows you never quite know how it's going to pan out.
Sure. And Gareth Southgate, obviously, now in charge. We've got the Nations League coming up in the summer. And then next year, it is, of course, Euro 2020. What are your hopes for those, Tom?
I think on the back of the World Cup, I think the team's gone from strength to strength. You know, Gareth's taken over. He's left no stone unturned in every department. That's been a key feature in the change that he's brought in. You know, on top of that, they've then had a good, solid World Cup. I think the perception of the team and the squad has changed. I think there's a much more positive outlook to it all from the media, from the public. And I think that was important because certainly in my first couple of years, there's a real negative aura and atmosphere that, you know, post-game and post-tournament. And I think that's been building for a few years, but it needed to change. And I think at the minute, it has changed, which is great. And I think can only be beneficial to the team and the country, that, in my opinion. So, yeah, very hopeful on the back of a semi-final World Cup. They've obviously got the Nations League semi-final this summer that I'm hoping to be a part of if selected. There's obviously four top sides there, but there's no reason why we can't go in real challenge for that. So, beyond that, the Euros is the next step, and it's important we keep improving, keep building. But if you look at the quality of the individuals coming through, we can get a little bit of luck at times, keep moving things in the right direction. There's no reason we can't be really successful over the next few years.
Last question. We always ask our guests the same question. It's quite a simple question, but it always gets a variety of answers. Tom Heaton, what has goalkeeping given you?
Enjoyment, I think. That would be the biggest thing for me. I enjoy trying to keep the ball out of the net. There's not a day go by that I don't enjoy going into training. Wouldn't do anything different in the world. I love improving at it. I love trying to get better, as I say. It's challenging at times. I think goalkeeping has given me a massive amount of enjoyment, and hopefully a lot more enjoyment to come.
Which is exactly what this podcast has given me, I have to say. Tom Heaton.
Enjoyed it myself.
Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Well, mate, you've previously said that goalkeepers are an intelligent breed. We can safely say Tom Heaton.
Point proven.
100%.
And he's not someone I've spoke to all that much over my career, and I'd love to speak to him more because the way in which his mind works, and there were certain words that he used there that really struck a chord with me. He used the word evidence a few times, and I know we had a bit of a joke about believe to see to believe, and we got a little bit mixed up, but the point is that, and this is for all you young goalkeepers out there, and you goalkeeper coaches as well, that there's another quote in psychology in which you can't outperform your own self-identity, right? Now, what that basically means is that you limit yourself. Now, if you dream to believe that little bit bigger, who's to say you can't go on and achieve it? So you can imagine Tom Heaton stepping out at Old Trafford for that first time in front of 50, 60, 70,000 people. He's never experienced it before. He uses the word evidence a lot. At that point, you don't have the evidence. So do you go out there and crumble because you've never experienced it before? Or do you believe to see? you can't see it first. The whole point is, if you see to believe, you have to see it before you believe in yourself. Well, the problem is with anything like football or anything you go into, you can't see it first. You need to believe it first. You need to believe that you're going to go on and become a fantastic goalkeeper, and you need to keep believing it. Even with all the knockbacks that you have, and you'll have thousands of them, keep believing it. Keep believing it and keep putting the work in. And Tom Heaton, it was his language that he used that really struck a chord, and you can see why he is so mentally strong, mentally astute, and why he's having and had the career that he's had.
And it's funny, just from that chat there, and actually if you read his interviews over the years, he's always talking about Kaizen, which is a big thing for you, continual, never-ending improvement. So that's a big part of his game, and massive credit to him. At the age of 24, Sir Alex Ferguson wanted to keep him at Old Trafford, and whether he would have played or not, I don't know, because if you wanted to keep someone there, he was 24 at the time, so you've got to give him a shot at some stage. But you had Edwin van der Sar. Eric Steele has admitted to us that he came in and he was tasked with finding a replacement for Edwin van der Sar, so he may not have got that shot. And to have the bravery, I suppose, because you could be comfortable at Old Trafford, right? You're at one of the biggest clubs in the world. To actually go, do you know what? I want to play first team football, and to step down a level, which is what he did, and then came all the way back round. So if anything, to be where he is now, I suppose, is a bit sweeter than it would have been to have come through those ranks at United.
Yeah, bravery is the right word. We've got a few good examples of that, I think, in the Premier League at the moment. I guess Neil Etheridge would be another good example. Ben Foster to a degree, I guess. Look, it's tricky because when you're at one of those top clubs, the general rule of thumb is that while there's still contracts on the table, you keep signing those contracts, because any move you're going to make is going to be down, and the chances are you're never going to get back to that level. However, Tom Heaton made it very well known. His desire was to play. I'm sure he could have maybe earned more money being a backup at Manchester United for 10 years and maybe got the odd game here and there, but his desire was to play, and was to play in big games, and you could tell that from speaking to him. So, and even at Cardiff, again, making the decision then to move on from Cardiff, and he said he had to go on a trial. You know, how often have we heard that, these top keepers? And it gets a lovely lesson for all you young goalkeepers out there listening into this, that it's not always plain sailing. And you might have 6 months a year that do not go your way. Nick Pope dropped down to Bury St Edmunds, I think it was. You know, the amount of amazing stories that we hear where it's not all plain sailing. The chances are you're going to have a setback or two along the way, but it's your ability to bounce back from those setbacks.
Okay, well, another lovely story, Richard, from the weekend, is the 19-year-old Mark Travers at Bournemouth, who was brought in for their game against Spurs, which they won in the dying minutes through Nathan Ake, a header. But Mark Travers made some very decent saves, only 19 years old.
Fantastic. Absolutely superb. And for those that know, Bournemouth have a very good goalkeeping department, and they're quite innovative in how they work. And I've known this for a few years. It's somewhere I'd love to visit, actually, because I've only read about it and through people I've spoken to. Neil Moss being a big part of what they do down there, of course, previously with Bournemouth. But they're now producing goalkeepers, because it's not only Mark Travers, they've also got Aaron Ramsdale, who, for those that don't know, he's done some exceptional things at AFC Wimbledon. AFC Wimbledon staying up on goal difference. They were as good as relegated when Aaron Ramsdale joined the club not so long ago. I think it was back in January. And he has been phenomenal, to the point where I think he won Player of the Season, even though he only joined them in January. So to have Mark Travers, to have Aaron Ramsdale coming through, it makes it a really interesting situation for Bournemouth going into next season, because if they are going to make a change, you do wonder if they look at these two young goalkeepers and give one of them a chance. Now, the chances are they won't, because in the Premier League, there is so much riding on it. They'll want to go with some form of experience to be the number one, but it must be so nice for them to know that they've got two of the very best up-and-coming goalkeepers. And in this particular game, huge credit to Mark Travers, some fantastic saves, but more so than that, I come back to the mindset. For a 19-year-old to step into a Premier League game and show that kind of confidence, it's very rare, but he looked fantastic. Body language was great. The saves he made, top draw, and he's got a big future.
I really want them to have faith, actually, on this one. And Eddie Howe, probably the manager in the Prem, probably to have that faith, because Artur Boric is nearly 40 now. It looks like Asmir Begovic is going to potentially leave. So you've got a 19-year-old and a 20-year-old there. Just play him. Give him a shot.
It'd be amazing. Remember Iker Casillas back in the day for Real Madrid, where I think his debut was a European Cup final. But it just doesn't happen anymore. That's the point. It doesn't happen. This comes back to the money in the Premier League and nobody willing to make a mistake. And of course, if you're giving someone a go who is untested, we spoke about it with Tom Heaton just there. You're giving somebody a go who's untested. It's a big decision to make, because if that costs you, then it could be your job on the line. So they will likely go with safety. But I think for these guys, it may be a case that they go on loan next season into the Championship or maybe even into League One just to get that experience. And if they can do that, then no doubt, give it a year or two, I think Bournemouth have got two very good goalkeepers that will be challenging for that number one spot.
Lovely stuff, boss.
Fantastic.
That's another one down.
Well, there you go.
Have you enjoyed it?
Do you know what? It has been. I say it every week, and I genuinely love this time of the week every week. Get to speak to someone different, different stories, everyone with different motivations. And I'm personally delighted with how this is going. I hope you're enjoying the podcast too.
I am, mate. I get to sit opposite you every week. So.
See, now I feel like you're mocking me.
No, not at all.
No sarcasm at all.
Absolutely no sarcasm whatsoever.
Well, look, I just want to say, always say it every week, but thanks again. I know the listeners have gone up again since last week in quite a big way. So thank you. Keep spreading the word, the goalkeeping word, the good goalkeeping word.
Good goalkeeping word. Absolutely. Spread it on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official. Just search GK Union on Facebook, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon and Goalkeepers 365.